Good afternoon and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA. I'm Kristen Malavenda and my guest this week is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. If you have questions for Mayor Dennis, you can call us at 765-496-1999. You can also email questions to ask@WBAA.org, or you can tweet them to @WBAA News on Twitter. We'd love to get you involved in the program today. Mayor Dennis, thanks so much for coming in and joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Kristen.
Happy New Year. Did you have a good holiday?
I did. Did you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I could use a vacation from my vacation, but other than that.
Well, or else in someplace warmer, right?
Exactly.
I mean, to my memory, I cannot recall it being this cold. And maybe that could just be my age now, but it sure is.
Well, I'm thinking maybe you have amnesia from last winter, because it was pretty cold last winter,
selective
too.
Amnesia, that's for sure.
All I know is my kids need to go back to school, and soon. So, but aside from that, I do want to start out asking you, you know, yesterday was the first day that candidates could file paperwork to run for a municipal office in 2015. Mm-hmm. You planning on running for mayor of West Lafayette again?
Yes, I am. We have not yet filed. It's going to be a pretty low-key, you know, filing. We're just going to go ahead and submit the paperwork and then, you know, just go ahead and start the process from there. We don't plan any significant announcement or anything. We'll just sort of do a low-key non-event.
Was there even a question about it, or you just, no-brainer, you were going for it?
Well, obviously, we've had a lot of encouragement and enthusiasm from the community. We feel that over the past almost 8 years now that we've been able to accomplish a lot of what we initially had intended to do, but we're not done yet. You know, when you're transitioning from a Class 3 to a Class 2 city, there's a lot of changes that are going to occur, both internally and in some cases even politically. And plus, we just feel that it would be somewhat incomplete to leave right now. We want to see it through to that first sort of lap, as it were, of going to a Class 2 city and make sure that things transition smoothly.
Great. Well, we mentioned and alluded to the extremely cold weather we've had this week. It's really our first blast of winter this mm-hmm. week. How did the city do, in your estimation, keeping the roads clear, keeping things moving this week?
Well, our street department guys did an amazing job. You know, we as a city became very acclimated to the way that our recently retired street commissioner, Dave Downey, did things. And you can always tell one of the qualities of a good leader is that they leave things in great shape. And that's not just operationally, but also insofar as training and making sure that routes are tight and that the staff know exactly what to do and when to do it. And our new guy, new street superintendent, Doug Payne, took over, and we didn't miss a beat. With the first, you know, heavy snow that we had, with the extremely low temperatures that we've had, the guys have been out. They've been clearing streets. They've been dealing with the public in a very professional, compassionate manner. And it's really just been yet another successful snow event. Now, the downside of that is I wish we had a better way to communicate some of the things that we do out there in the community and some of the things that we can't do. Obviously, when we have weather temperatures that are this extreme, there are certain things that just don't work the way that we would like for them to do so. And one of those products is salt. The natural reaction when folks see a slippery road or a slippery surface is to ask the street department to go ahead and throw some salt on it. But when it's this cold, the salt really doesn't have any effect. The salt would actually be a better secondary surface for traction as opposed to actually melting the snow or the ice. So what we generally do is when temperatures are this cold, we just encourage people to drive safely, to be aware of their environment. And if there is an area that needs some sort of assistance, we'll go ahead and throw some sand on it until the temperature warms up or until we get the appropriate amount of friction so that we can go ahead and treat it more thoroughly.
Now, there's been in the news lately that some communities that either didn't have the money or didn't buy salt in advance, it's super expensive right now. How is West Lafayette in its salt stores? And, you know, did you have to pay an arm and a leg for it?
Well, we had to pay an arm. That's for sure. And it was a little bit higher than it was in years past. But we were prepared for it. We've got a fairly significantly sized storage facility, and we had it filled up towards the end of last year with the assumption that the prices were going to go up, and that assumption came to be true. But the fact of the matter is that it takes several tons of salt through each winter season to go ahead and make sure that you appropriately treat your roads. And we usually refill our storage facility about three times before the season's out, and that's on a predictably normal, you know, West Lafayette winter. But our hope is, from what we understand, you know, we've got a lot of weather prognosticators out there, and they always sort of let us know what we can expect in the coming winter months. And what we believe to be true is that severe weather comes in pairs. Usually, if you have a bad winter, you can pretty much bet the bank on you're going to have a pretty severe winter the following year. So we've been gearing up with that understanding in mind. So all of our equipment's ready. You know, again, Commissioner Payne has done some pretty creative stuff on trying to get some new equipment on the road. We've got some new trucks. We've got some new blades that was donated to the that were donated to the city from NDOT. And I'd like to emphasize the word used. but there's something we can put on 231 to assist with removing snow and ice on 231. And then like anything else, we can have all the material and equipment in the world, but when the weather turns severe, the most important thing on the road is the driver. And they just need to understand that you've got to change your driving habits when it's cold. You've got to change your driving habits when it's icy. And you need to be make sure there's extra added stopping distance and just go slow and be careful. And if you don't need to go out, stay home.
Now, you last month when you were on the program, you talked to news director Stan Jastrzebski about the city's new natural gas trash trucks. And you were a little concerned how they were going to perform in the cold weather. Have you had any sense of how they've operated? Have there been any problems?
No, not that we're aware of. Everything's running fairly smoothly. One of the things that we're really fortunate in having is we have a storage facility. So the trucks that are going to get the most daily usage, we can keep inside. And that's a bonus for us because you don't have to go through that half hour to 45 minute right. warm-up period. So we're able to do that with all of our routine use trucks. The downside of that is we've grown as a city and our equipment needs have grown and been, and so we're sort of running out of space. And that's something that we'll look at in the future. We're probably going to have to go and build another storage facility so we can keep all of our equipment undercover both in the summer and the winter. But as it stands right now, no, we've had no problem insofar as making sure the equipment's up and running. We've got a really strong fleet maintenance staff. And they do an amazing job of making sure things are ready to go. But the important factor is, again, it's the equipment's one thing, but the humans behind the steering wheels and on the back of the trucks, those are the guys that are doing all the work, and I could not be more proud of them.
Now, let's get to a question. We have a couple of emailed questions from a listener. Chris emailed, and she, first of all, wanted to say thanks for helping make this a great city in which to live, which means usually there's a hard question coming after that. She's buttering
yeah,
you up.
First you get the smile.
Exactly. Her question is, why did the construction on Cumberland Avenue not get finished before the winter? And she says some sections were closed, and she didn't know it until she drove right up to it, and then she had to drive, you know, way out of her way to get back onto Cumberland. Mm-hmm. So what's the status of Cumberland, and why didn't it get finished before winter?
Well, first off, Chris, thank you so much for the compliment. And again, it's not me, it's my staff. Those are the folks that are doing all the work. But Cumberland Avenue, you know, when we do an audit every year of our streets and obviously prior to getting to work on that stretch between Salisbury and Soldiers Home, Cumberland Avenue was the bar none award winner of the worst street in the city. The good news and bad news about that is that that obviously meant that it was going to get a significant amount of attention. But the bad news is that street was in rough shape because it's so old. That street in some places is over 50 years old. And as a little kid, I grew up right off of Cumberland Avenue, and I can remember it was just a single road, just two lanes. So when you have a street that's that old, there's a lot of stuff on the surface that's going wrong, and then a lot of stuff, and this is probably more to the point, underneath the surface that's going wrong. The first thing that you have is utilities. And due to the date and the age of the street, there were a lot of utilities that were added after the street had actually been laid. And when you have to do that, while there's an existing surface that's being utilized, it requires a lot of creativity in laying down those utilities. And sometimes that creativity doesn't add to efficiency. So one of the first things that we needed to do with that stretch of Cumberland Avenue is sort of realign all the utilities under there. And that means water, that means gas, that means electricity, in some cases that means cable and sewer. And generally speaking, when you're building a road, that's one of the hardest things to do. Most specifically, when you're dealing with a gas line. If that's not done correctly, there could be a very serious and unfortunate incident that would occur. So that needed to be treated almost surgically. And then all the other utilities, you need to coordinate with the utility company to make sure that you're not going to create any disruptions in service and get all those things sorted out prior to doing any real constructions on the road. And then after that, the biggest challenge you have is Mother Nature. There's two things that Mother Nature often does. First time, she'll give you a long stretch to where you can do a lot of preliminary work, and then when it gets down to the actual creation of the road, in other words, flattening the surface, laying down your subsurfaces, getting the curbs and sidewalks ready, that's when Mother Nature decides to play tricks on you. And that's what happened this year. We had a very wet fall, and that created a lot of challenges for us to be able to actually do things and do it in a way that wouldn't require for us to come back in the next few years to redo some of those products that we were putting into the road. And probably most importantly, because of the number of driveways, the number of roads, and the number of intersecting components that we have with that particular road project, it just takes time. And you cannot you cannot replace a road without removing it. Right. So that also creates some challenges. Prior to doing the road project, we met with our with the neighborhood, the Avondale neighborhood, and the folks that are going to be most directly affected by the project. And we every meeting we tried to make sure that everybody was aware of that this is going to be painful. It's a quarter mile of road that has a lot of connectivity with a lot of citizens, and it's going to be painful. And I understand that. My hope is that we won't, you know, have written a patience check to our community that we can't cash. We're doing as much as we can to make it as painless as possible. We appreciate the patience on the part of the folks that are most immediately affected. And we also appreciate the connectivity that our city of our engineers department has had with those folks so that we can make adjustments as necessary.
Is it at a standstill now? And what's the, you know, when do you go again? What's the marker where you can start working again?
Well, the construction season generally ends towards the end of November and doesn't open again until after the first good thaw. And again, that's just because you can't lay some of these products on the road in cold weather. There's some things that we can do, but generally speaking, there's not going to be a whole lot of progress made until the construction season starts up again in the spring.
And how complicated is it? You've got that kind of gap in the middle of the road in terms of plowing. If we get a lot more snow, is that going to be manageable, especially with the school right there?
No, absolutely. One of the things that we're well aware of is this isn't going to be a traditional road to plow. You know, we're going to have to use some special equipment and make sure that we get folks out there early to make sure the snow is going to be manageable. The construction company that's doing the job right now is also assisting us with that. So in the event that we have a significant snow event, we're going to go ahead and use all the apparatus that we have within the city and also use the assistance of the construction company to make sure the snow gets off the road.
And then to her point about, I guess she felt that maybe it wasn't signed correctly where some areas were closed off. Are you comfortable that the officials are constantly reevaluating, is this marked correctly?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we have is you have the presumption about any city project is that it's city folks that are doing it. And unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case. And most specifically with Cumberland Avenue, that's not the case. We hire contractors to do the work. There's engineering firms that do design work. Our city engineer and public works director, they look at all the plans and make sure everything's right. But then again, we basically hire people to do that work. And we establish parameters, things that we demand that they do with every project. And one of the things that we demand that they do is they make it safe. They make it drivable. They make it so that people, you know, if they're from Frankfurt and they come into town, that they will know how to navigate that road without a great deal of confusion and stress. Sometimes they're great. They do a great job. Sometimes they're not. And we drive that road. Somebody from my staff drives that road every day, and they check those sort of things. But every now and again, something slips. Or a project is supposed to be completed by a certain date. The signage is set up so that to do the necessary exchange of information based upon that eventual completion date. And things go wrong, whether it be the weather or a piece of equipment or something doesn't go right, and it turns the informational signs into false information signs. But as soon as somebody, on whether one of the construction team members or somebody from my staff are made aware of it, we do an immediate change order and get things repaired. So our hope is that we don't have anything like that happen, but unfortunately sometimes things beyond the scope of our control occur, and it does actually happen. One of the biggest things that we found is that when we were doing the work, the seasons were changing and the daylight hours were changing. And so the guys would still be out there working and it would be a little dark and they would go ahead and close for the night and they wouldn't properly light some of the areas. And some of our citizens have made me aware of the fact that that created a bit of a hazard. So we've remedied that. And again, that's probably the best way for us to get information. We can have our engineers out there and our construction folks out there, but if citizens feel that there is a hazard or something that needs to be remedied, just give my office a call and we'll get to it immediately.
Thanks, Chris, so much for that question. If you have questions for Mayor Dennis, you can call us at 765-496-1999. You can also email your questions to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet them to @WBAAnews on Twitter. Chris had another question as well. Mm-hmm. She's curious about the old CVS building out there at the intersection of 52 and Salisbury. Who does the city own that? Does the company still own it? And, you know, what are their plans, if any, for getting that filled?
You know, I probably get asked about that at least once a month because it is so obviously empty.
Right. And has been for a long time.
And has been for a very long time and will be for much longer. First off, the city has no control, no authority. There is nothing we can do as local government to get that situation remedied. The urban legend is actually fact. The ground is owned by a private citizen. That private citizen is leasing the ground to CVS.
Okay.
So CVS owns the building, owns the structure but doesn't own the ground. So what that means is it's up to CVS to make the determination as to whether or not they want to keep it there. Now, what we've been told is that that is not a that's not an uncommon marketing control scheme that's used by international and national franchises. They'll go ahead and buy property, not necessarily to develop, but to keep somebody else from developing it so they don't have competition right across the street. And from what we've been told, that is the plan that's going on here.
Oh, so they want to keep it empty so that it, like another drug company, mm-hmm. pharmaceutical company, doesn't buy it?
And... Correct. That's what we've been told. Now, they obviously, if there was a developer that had the right numbers, I'm sure that something would change. But as it stands right now, we have catered everybody from Starbucks to see if they might want to relocate there, because where they are right now is a little bit challenging, access and egress.
Absolutely.
We've called Trader Joe's, which would be neat there. Yep. But again, the cost to move into that location is prohibitive for folks that are interested in coming to the community. So as it stands right now, you know, we probably have a conversation about this every season. And, you know, Chandler Poole, our director of development, Dave Buck, our city engineer, and myself, we've done everything that we believe within our power to try and encourage somebody to come there, but it just doesn't happen.
It's frustrating because it's a major intersection in the city. Mm-hmm. It, like you said, everybody knows it's mm-hmm. empty, it's there, and you're wondering mm-hmm. what needs to be done.
Oh, and one of the things that we've been using as a cornerstone of our administration is we want to make sure that West Lafayette has the right taste and feel and appearance that suits our unique personality. And when you come in on 52, it's just not that appealing. Now, thankfully, 52 is going to be relinquished and it's going to be part of the city. So we're going to be empowered to do a lot of stuff with that particular stretch of roadway. But when it comes to privately owned developable properties, we're challenged. You know, I mean, there's a lot of folks that look at some of the developments that go on, and you'll have these amazing, incredibly aesthetically appealing developments, and then all of a sudden you'll see a stop and go, or you'll see something that people associate with either a stronger urban environment,
right,
or something that doesn't fit a near campus or near neighborhood location. And they call up the office and say, why are you doing that? Why don't you stop that? Make that go away, or make them do this, or make them do that. And if the development complies with the existing zoning, if it complies with the basic design plan, if it complies with easements and site distances and things like that, there is absolutely nothing we can do. You know, we try to develop good relationships with people that are coming into our community, developers that are coming into our community, and try and encourage them to do things that would be aesthetically appealing. But again, if you get a national franchise that has a certain product type,
right,
they're going to put it there, and the only thing we can do is try and inform our neighbors to create a sense of activism on their part, you know, because sometimes that works stronger than government.
Another building that somebody just asked me about was the old Long John Silver's building down by the levee. It's next to, you know, Wendy's. That's been empty for a while now. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what's going on with that?
Yeah, sure. That was actually remodeled with the understanding that they were going to put some, either a coffee shop or something to that effect in there. And again, it's our understanding that the developer, I think, was financially distracted and had to go and realign some things before he could finish the product. I believe, and again, I haven't been by there for a while, I think it's for sale.
Okay.
And they call that white boxing an area. That's basically when you clean it up, you neutralize it so it doesn't look like any particular franchise product, and then somebody can come in there and make it their own.
Do whatever they want
right.
to do
and
with it.
And I think that's where they are with that particular project right now.
And, you know, ever-present is the levee, and every time I drive down there, first of all, I lament the fact that there's not a big bookstore there anymore, yeah. But I also just... You know, I can't believe the number of empty storefronts uh-huh. that are down there. How much does the development of that depend on the State Street Master Plan? Are you waiting for some of that to happen before you do more? Where does that stand?
Well, it's interesting. When you look at our history, not just as a city, but as a state and a country, the philosophy of a downtown had a particular look and feel to it.
Right.
It was individual units, whether they were single story or multiple story, connected, and that gave that boulevard-esque, that downtown look, that Main Street look that we all, at least from our generation,
yeah.
were used to looking at. Then around the late 70s and early 80s, this concept of strip malls came in to vogue. And they were very popular. I mean, they were popping up all over the state like nobody's business. And West Lafayette was no different. And then when they had the opportunity to take the old Sears lot and the old wrecking lot, the dump that they had there, and turn it into something that would be of value to our community, you know, wisely so they did it. Well, it's reached its timeline.
Right.
And we are now seeing that the strip mall concept doesn't necessarily carry the aesthetic appeal that the downtown, the classic downtown look does. So because of that, we're seeing vendors sort of rotate through Wabash Landing. And generally speaking, they have a lot of interest because you have a guaranteed market with our student population here. As one developer told me, they've got 40,000 wallets just waiting to be opened.
Yeah.
Open. So that's encouraging for a developer. But the fact of the matter is that you're not going to see the same quality of businesses that you used to about 10 or 15 years ago because that philosophy has changed. And plus, retail in general is starting to change. We just got through the Christmas season, and, you know, I would be interested to know how much time you spent in a store versus how much time you spent online shopping.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and that's what people are doing. So, you know, when you look at things like, you know, the internet, when you look at the different age demographic that's doing the shopping now, you know, the old Santa in the supermarket is going to kind of go away. And we as city leaders need to be agile enough to be able to respond to that. And when we're doing city planning, that is one of the things that we consider. You know, what is the future of the marketplace? What is going to be the draw? What type of businesses still is going to be able to generate that type of pedestrian traffic in and out of the business?
Yeah.
And it's difficult to, you know, if we had crystal balls, we could predict that. But it's really difficult to say.
Yeah, and it's kind of perplexing just because it's not like that's a vacant area. There's lots of traffic down there. The businesses that are down there seem to do well and have a lot of traffic. So the fact that all those others just remain empty is it's frustrating.
It is.
To
it
see. Is. We got about 5 minutes left here on today's program. I wanted to ask you a follow-up about body cameras for the police department. Now, back in September, I did a feature. I talked to Chief Domkowski and Stason. Is that the officer that was wearing?
Weedy. Yeah.
Stason Weedy was wearing the, he was the first one to wear the body camera. And this was prior to Ferguson and the Staten Island incidents. And so weird that West Lafayette, Indiana, the small town, kind of a trendsetter.
Hey, wait a second.
Well, maybe not weird, but
how about prophetic?
So I'm wondering, you know, with your background in law enforcement, I'm sure that you had a particular interest in how that was going to play out. What have you heard about how those are being used? Is there any resident response about seeing them?
Well, there is a level of comfort about that, and both on the part of the administration and on the part of the police officers themselves. Back in my day, and again, I'm going to date myself here. Back in my day, the only technology that we had was our radio. I mean, we had a microphone on the radio, and you pick it up, and that's how you would basically track everything that you did. And when, because I worked internal affairs for a while, and when complaints would come in, it would be the officer's word versus the complainant's word. And sometimes there would be a fairly significant complaint made, and you would have to do an investigation just like you would if you're investigating a crime. And the belief system at that time was, well, if a police officer says that, it must be true. And I'm not talking about in general, but there was a lot of things that went on that way that were necessarily right, but it was just part of that time. Well, we have since evolved, and we started getting more technology into law enforcement. One of the first big changes actually were the car cams on the cars.
The dashboard cams.
Right. Yep. And that actually occurred when I was still actively involved in law enforcement. And it proved to be an outstanding tool when it came to complaints. Somebody could file a complaint against a police officer, and if the car was in a position to where it could record it, boom, you had an actual factual-based objective view of what took place. Well, now we've moved on to the next level. We've gone from the general accountability to the specific accountability, hence things like Ferguson, things like New York, and things like that have gone around in the country most recently. The body cams are the primary tool when it comes to having personal accountability on the part of the police officer, and also for accurately documenting the events that occur in any given situation when the camera's on. There is policy that governs when the cameras go on. When they go on a call, as soon as they get out, they hit the switch and the camera goes on. And it is just that next level of understanding of what we need to do to make sure that our system is transparent. And the other side of that is that anybody who goes, whether you work on campus or whether you work in a city, because of cell phones, smartphones, and the video camera, the smartphones, anytime a police officer gets out of that car, there's probably four or five phones on.
Absolutely.
And specifically in a college town, everybody's got phones. So it's inevitable. It's a good thing. It heightens up the accountability of the police officer, and it also documents the event should there be some sort of issue brought up in the future. You know, I'm delighted that we had him. I was very, very strongly encouraging that we do so. And again, you know, being an old retired guy now, I look back at some of the situations that we were involved in when we were young police officers, and it would have been nice to have that type of technology back then.
Now, they're real small, too. They're like what an old pager used to look like, and literally it's very easy to just flip up the lens and it turns it turns right on. I know after West Lafayette did it, Indianapolis Police Department started to do it, and they said they were consulting some other departments that are already using them. Is West Lafayette serving in that capacity, helping other departments?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, what we know is what we see. We know we've got the cameras now. We know that they're a device that can be used to help document situations, but the back office obligations of those particular devices are significant as well. Those videos take up a ton of space on a server.
Right.
And there is a lot of technology that we have to purchase to support those cameras as well. And when you look at a department or an agency the size of the Indianapolis Police Department, that is a substantial investment. Very substantial.
Because you're talking about recording every single interaction you have,
well,
right?
You can, sure. I mean, as soon as you get out of the car, you can flick it on.
Yeah.
So you can, and then there needs to be, there's an evidentiary standard that needs to be held as well. What do you keep? What do you throw away? And how do you get the permission to throw certain things away? And it's still, actually, as technology, it's still evolving. We really don't know all the parameters of this technology.
Okay, we have just about a minute left. I was just curious, Lafayette and Tippecanoe County both recently redid their animal control ordinances for different reasons, but basically for the same goal, to kind of control the animal population. Mm-hmm. Is there any thought in West Lafayette that that's something that needs to be done?
Well, we've had some conversation with individual council members about this, and it might be something that we're going to visit in the near future. We have over 127 different countries represented in the city of West Lafayette, and there's a lot of different cultures that come to our community. And there's certain behaviors that might not work well in other communities that work well here, so we need to be sensitive to that.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today. Happy New Year. Thanks again for listening to Ask the Mayor today. If you have a question for Mayor Dennis, we can save it for next month. If you have a question for any one of our mayors, next week's show will be with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Go ahead and send those questions at any time to ask@WBAA.org, or you can tweet them to @WBAA News on Twitter. And this show will be posted along with all the other Ask the Mayor broadcasts on our website. That's at WBAA.org. Mayor Dennis, have a great day. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.